thank you to everybody who is here today. I'm really glad you're here. And if you are in California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, you might be struggling with the fires, the smoke. I know I am. I am about 300 miles north of San Francisco, and it's brown outside, and it's, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. And this is, I just really want to name this right off, that you may be feeling some real distress and worry around what's happening in our skies with all of these fires. And if you've been directly affected by the fires, I hope you're safe, and thank you for showing up. The skies are unlike anything I've ever seen. And Ellen, I can see you pointing behind you. Exactly. And it's very eerie to be in this time. So I'll tell you just off the get-go, I'm having a little bit of lung stuff today. So if I'm coughing a bit, you'll understand. So stay hydrated, stay inside. This is what we've got, right? This is our practice of now, today, in this moment. This is how it is. How are we going to be with this? So just to start off, I love how we start off by typing in where we're coming from. And the other thing that's really lovely is take a look at one another. You know, even if you need to scroll through your screen to go to the next page, just do it so you can see the faces of all of us who are here. Or even if people have their cameras off, just noticing names. Maybe there are people that you recognize. But in this way, we really welcome ourselves and each other into practice by just seeing who's here, just saying hello, just through looking. It's very sweet. It's really, really sweet to be able to do this. It warms my heart. I like this a lot. One of the things I want to add to our time together is to really know that we are in each other's homes. And in that way, we are guests in each other's homes. So keep in mind that whatever you're doing on camera, we can all see. Whatever I'm doing on camera, you can see. So just to keep that in mind and in consideration of our practice, the intention to quiet the mind and cultivate this kind presence, try to be somewhat still in your movements. Or if you need to get up and move around, just turn your camera off because it is distracting. And that's the request. That's my request for that. So as always, we will begin our practice this morning with an arriving meditation. My favorite way to begin any kind of meeting, any kind of time together, is just to take a few minutes to settle. So finding a comfortable posture where you feel connected to the earth, to the ground, whether you're sitting or standing or lying down. Sense into the body, to the places it's touching, whatever you're connected to. And if you like to close your eyes, or hold a soft downward gaze. And taking a few deliberate breaths to arrive. Sensing into the inhale and the exhale, letting each breath cycle be an arriving and a settling. Welcoming yourself into practice, knowing practice is a place, but practice is also a quality of being where we're always welcomed. Like sitting down with a good friend who is always here for us. I'm just settling in for a couple minutes. And I'd like to offer you a reflection question. Given all that you've experienced in the last 6 months, all of the profound changes, the shifting in life, and even today, with the way the air is, the way the world is, what is still true for you? Given everything, what is still true? And whatever arises, notice, is there a reverberation in the body when you come into this awareness of what is still true? How does that land in the body? Okay, coming back, please. I wonder if anybody would like to share. Okay, what came up for you? What is still true? Let's just hear from a couple people. Love to know what you think. And you can raise the hand or wave, and Carlita will see you if you'd like to share. Great.
What came up for me was gratitude that everyone in my family was healthy,
yeah,
and that I was safe. And those are still true. I don't know for how long, but as this moment in this day, those are true. And yeah, it put me in deep gratitude.
Thank you. It's so important, isn't it? To really recognize that, because we can be very hijacked by what is not still true, and the sadnesses and the fears. Thank you, Barbara. Who else? Maureen, I see.
I felt a sense of survival, you know, and I felt gratitude for past trials that I learned things from. Mm-hmm. Like, just kind of, I have orchids in my house, and it sounds funny, but they make me feel good. And when I got up this morning, I was totally disoriented. I thought my alarm clock was off. And I have a lot of allergies. So I woke up in the middle. So there was all these physical things. And, you know, I didn't know, like, I didn't eat breakfast right away. You know, I'm my biological clock was finished. But as you said, it is what it is. So I kind of reached into my drawer and pulled out, you know, mindful attitudes that just make me feel some peace within all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is still true. And the orchids are still there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. One more.
Heidi, I did have one come in via chat.
Yeah.
What's consistent is change and struggle.
Yeah. And that is still true. Thank you for that, right? Deep Dharma truth. What is still true is change and struggle. Everything is in the process of changing, and it's hard. It's hard. So we will have more time to talk with each other throughout our morning. So I apologize if I didn't get to hear your reflection, but I want to move forward. So if you want to bring that in later and you think you might forget, just jot it down and we'll try to meet that later. So as we move into our practice this morning, I want to do a little bit of a recap on last week as a reminder for those who were here and as a little bit of refresh for those who weren't here, so we're all up to speed. I shared that last year during a retreat that I sat, I came out of that retreat with three very strong intentions for my life and for my practice. And these three intentions were to disentangle, dissolve contention, forgive everyone, and wake up. No small thing, right? Dissolve contention, forgive everyone, and wake up. And that's a feedback loop, right? The more we wake up, the more we let go of contention, the more it's clear we need to let go of grudges and that which keeps our heart armored. And the more we let go of, the more empathy and loving kindness, the more we understand others, the more we wake up, the more we let go of contention. So these all work in conjunction with each other. And so then I offered some thoughts on two ways that we need to do this with the ground of steadiness, strength, and courage, because we can't do that without a certain foundation of strength, steadiness, and courage that we get from our practice, that we get from one another, from our life experience. But there are two primary ways that I want to explore how I find that I can work with those intentions. And one is through renunciation, the practice of letting go over and over and over again, exploring self-restraint, exploring all the ways that I can release and simplify. And the other way that we'll explore today is faith. Faith from the context of trust and confidence. So just a short recap on renunciation, how I relate to what that is. I think that the practice of letting go, of restraint, of simplifying, of releasing, is a path to dissolving greed, ill will, and delusion. Because every single time we release a little bit, the things that we're holding on to that we want more of become less potent because we get a little space around it. That's how the renunciation releases that graspiness, the greed, any way that that shows up for us. The other thing that it does is it helps to disentangle the ill will that really can hijack and degrade our hearts. And the more we let go, the clearer we see, because the mind, the brain, is literally not constricted. And we all know what it's like, you know, when the brain is, we might be in fight, flight, freeze, or so single-minded about something, we can't think about anything else. And that is a level of delusion when we cannot have a little broader perspective. So renunciation is the path, I believe, one of the paths to dissolving these three poisons of greed, ill will, and delusion. And I offered four different kinds of renunciation paths or aspects of what we need to release. One is things, of course, material, stuff, experiences. And I think this is a practice of knowing deeply sufficiency, the practice of enoughness, and being able to perhaps imagine the continuum line between prosperity and scarcity and how we float on that. You know, we that changes all the time, just like was offered here. What is still true is change and struggle. And so the change is happening, and sometimes we struggle with the change. So we let go of the things that keep us caught. The other aspect of renunciation is letting go of how we want other people to be. I would say that that's a big one. What are our relationships to the relationships? Can we let go of people? Sometimes we have to let go of friendships. Sometimes we have to let go of relationships or jobs or all of these different ways in which the people we're interacting with don't stay the same or don't do what we want. And that's really hard, you know, when somebody, especially who's close to us, doesn't behave or show up in exactly how we want them to, that's painful. Can we let go of needing the people in our lives to be exactly how we want them? The third aspect is letting go of views, our opinions that inform us so deeply, limiting beliefs, really being able to look at how we are caught in the wasp's nest of views. That's how it feels to me sometimes. You know, if I'm so caught and I can't find my way out of that, the problem of fixed views, the problem that come from these opinions, are they coming, what is the intention behind them? Are they coming from ill will or are they coming from a good-hearted place? And that's an important thing that maybe at some time we'll really dig into, is not all views are a problem. And that's an important thing. We can have very strong core beliefs that we align our lives with. And these are the wholesome aspects, the things that lead to good. I'm not talking about we should not have belief systems that really lead to non-harming and the good of our own well-being. But as Anais Nin said, we don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are. And we can't help that because of our conditioning, because we all have filters, but our practice helps us open those curtains a little bit to say, not only what is still true, but there's another aspect of that question that says, and what else is true? That's a very important other side of the coin. So we talked about what is it like to be right? What is it like to be wrong? That feeling of threat when we're wrong, or that feeling of strength and that endorphin hit we can get when we're right, that righteousness. And that's also a big conversation. We talked a lot about that last week. I found this poem I wanted to share with you about that piece of rightness and wrongness. This is from Yehuda Amichai, who's an Israeli poet, called The Place Where We Are Right. From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. But doubts and loves dig up the world like a mole, a plow, and a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. I love that, because where the ruined house once stood, that's all of the suffering that we create by our insistence that things be a certain way, this rightness. But when there's a crack in that, that's when the little weed can grow up. That's when there's some space and new things can come around. So can we willingly suspend our loyalty to our own opinions long enough to let something else in? And that can be very threatening, but that's part of our practice, to intentionally, on purpose, suspend our loyalty to our own opinions long enough to say, I wonder why you feel that way. Can you tell me? Just another view. And lastly, the fourth part of renunciation is letting go of fears that keep us stuck. Certainly I'm afraid of these skies. I'm afraid of going outside and that it's going to harm my health. I'm afraid of the fires. But I think that from the perspective of renunciation, what we're talking about with letting go of fear is, are we willing to be present with what is? And are we willing to try? Can we trust our own innate goodness? What to be able to see what keeps us frightened that keeps us stuck? And what keeps us frightened that's appropriate? And this is part of the practice, but not to be stuck in the fear. And what is so important is that we can look around at what is happening in our world, and it is frightening. But how I relate to that, to work with that fear, is to recommit over and over again to the precepts of non-harming, to really working with what supports my well-being and do that, and what doesn't support my well-being and don't do that. And it might be as immediate as I'm not going to go outside today. That doesn't support my well-being. That's an appropriate response. And so we keep working with how we can let go of whatever is present, be it views, people, material things, or controlling beliefs, fears that keep us stuck. I love the question from the Buddha that says, what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? That's a way to work with all of these aspects of renunciation. What when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? Because it gives us the big picture. And that's what we need. One of the definitions of equanimity is perspective. And that's very helpful to have perspective. So that's what we talked about last week. 10-minute summary. And I'd like to move into our meditation. But if somebody has a question you'd really like to put forth before we do that on any of that, I'd love to hear from you. Wadia?
Okay, thank you so much, and good afternoon. It's afternoon in New York City. I know it's morning there.
I'm glad to hear from New York. Great.
Thank you. With regards to renouncing these things, others, and views, I'm struggling because to let it go, the change, as you talked about earlier, is hard. So as I'm purging, I'm crying, I'm angry, and then it feels good. It's like a myriad of feelings and emotions, and it's like a roller coaster, but I know that it's for my greater good, and it's helping me. I understand that, but the roller coaster, because you're letting it go, and you to let something in, to soften and to appreciate and be grateful, but it's then you're plagued with it coming back. So I don't know how to. I mean, I'm assuming that it's natural to feel this way, but can you give me some insight on the ins and outs and the?
Keep going. Keep okay. Noticing what's happening. I think that your own wisdom is right there for you, that you know you're letting go, and the feelings of sadness and anger, mm-hmm. or even delight, like maybe some relief, all of it is coming in, is just to know that experience as it's happening, to be willing to turn towards it. This is the practice, to say, right now, this is how anger feels.
Yeah.
How it is. That whatever we are feeling is the path and the fruit of the practice. This is what is happening. And it's said that our practice is a purification.
Yeah, I feel that way. Burning
out what we don't need. And if you can stick with it, stick with your practice, keep coming to class, be part of Sangha, it will be supportive. So really, my best response is keep going.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Okay, let's move into our meditation. So once again, finding a comfortable place for your body, whether you're sitting down, standing up, lying down. Maybe you're even going to do walking meditation for this period. Whatever supports you most, the invitation is to do that. Feel the earth beneath you, because the earth is beneath us. Beneath, if you're outside, it's right there. If you're inside, it's below the building. Just feel that deep connection to the earth, grounded in the body. Feel how the spine rises out of the low back, all the way to the crown of the head. This is this upright, bright energy that keeps us attentive. And then to the extent possible, softening the front of the body, the face, the throat, the chest and the belly. Let those belly muscles go so there's room to breathe. Sensing into that place where you feel your breath the most, wherever it is, belly, chest, nostrils, or maybe nowhere in particular, just the experience of breathing. Get a little closer to that place where you feel your breath. And then notice the hands, how they are resting wherever they are, whether they're clasped, resting on the arms of a chair, or gently in the lap. Even let the hands relax, which sends the message of deeper relaxation up the arms and into the shoulders and the neck. From this place of strong back, soft front, let your awareness turn inwards and settle wherever it feels most appropriate for you, either on the breath or somewhere in the body, maybe the feet, the seat, or the hands, and try to stay there. And as we sit quietly when the mind wanders, please know it's not a problem. It's quite natural. But in the noticing, come back and begin again. And we'll sit quietly. Thoughts will naturally arise. And knowing that some thoughts are worrisome and agitating, of course, some thoughts are delightful and easeful, enticing, whatever they are. It's easy for the mind to just go off in thought. Maybe offering yourself the instruction, not now, don't know, let it go. Not now, don't know, let it go. Just letting it go off to the side, it'll be there later. if you're noticing discomfort, constriction, tightness in the body, see if you can bring a little breath to that area, inviting it to soften, maybe to open just a little bit. Perhaps you're noticing that the mind has settled a little bit. That the body is even relaxed, and maybe the heart is a little more present. You can sense into it. Just notice any amount of ease or stillness that has arisen. And rest your awareness right there inside any amount of ease or stillness. Let it expand if you can. When we sense into this ease or stillness, there's a natural letting go, the releasing of anything that constricts the mind or heart. And an openness is right there. This is a practice of renunciation. Of letting go of everything except what is right here. And sometimes that is the difficulty, that there is difficulty right here. And we offer any difficulty our warmth, our compassion, which often allows that to relax and soften just a little bit. Continuing to sense into any ease, knowing the breath, sensing the body, just being here. Now drawing the awareness into the heart center, just sensing into the heart, knowing or getting a sense also of the state of the heart right now. How is it now? Knowing and allowing it to be just as it is. The worries, the fears, the joys, knowing what is still true, what else is true. This is the state of heart. You may enjoy the practice of the heart's breath, of imagining breathing in and out of the heart center from every direction in, back out into every direction. Remembering the back of the heart as well. Bringing fresh energy into the heart space and allowing it to become a little more spacious, stable, grounded, available. Try that if you like. And through this practice of the heart's breath, we make space for ourselves and one another to be just as we are. And whatever our level of ease or stillness or contentment, may our happiness grow, may it continue. Happiness as a quality of contentment, just this right now, any amount. May our contentment grow, may it continue. Here's a poem from Mary Oliver called I Worried. I worried a lot. Will the garden grow? Will the rivers flow in the right direction? Will the earth turn as it was taught? And if not, how shall I correct it? Was I right? Was I wrong? Will I be forgiven? Can I do better? Will I ever be able to sing? Even the sparrows can do it, and I am, well, hopeless. Is my eyesight fading, or am I just imagining it? Am I going to get rheumatism, lockjaw, dementia? Finally, I saw that worrying had come to nothing and gave it up and took my old body and went out into the morning and sang. So before we pause for a break, just notice how you feel right now. Any amount of ease or stillness that has come up, let it spread inside of you. Just let it spread. It helps hold the worries. Great, thanks. Let's take a 5-minute break and we'll come back to share some Dharma thoughts. Thank you. Okay, we'll start to come back. I'll ring the bell for people, see if you can hear it. What is still true is the bell is a nice way to come back. Just to come back into the room, if you can hear it. You know, people are arriving. One more, because it's fun. Okay, everybody. So what I want to look at this morning is how do I let go of the things that keep me caught? Because it's one thing to talk about these beautiful Dharma teachings, and it's another thing to get into the nitty-gritty of how do I actually do this? And for me, it's been very important in my own practice when I hear the teachings and I think, oh, that makes so much sense. Yes, of course, I want to move in that direction, but I don't always know how. And this is where our practice of taking the teachings and applying them, living them in our daily life, that we need support to do that. So this is... the how of how I am looking at dissolving contention, forgiving everyone, learning to wake up bit by bit, these moments of deeper understanding through the process of releasing the things that keep me stuck. But the way that I have found that is really critical for this is this practice of faith. And from the Buddhist perspective, the word is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A. And it, my understanding is that the translation is to place the heart upon. Isn't that beautiful? Faith as to place the heart upon. This is a commitment to practice, a commitment to non-harming, a commitment to aligning our lives in line with these values of goodness, the values of wholesomeness, of non-harming. And it also can be, sadha can be thought of as trust or confidence. I can do this. I can do this. Just as Wadia was sharing, it's hard. It can be painful. The pain of living our lives in line with our practice is not easy. It is not easy because we are alive, feeling human beings, and we feel everything from the despair to the joy, the anger, the blame, the resentment, the praise, the blame, the gain, the loss, right? The eight worldly winds of praise, blame, shame, fame, pleasure, pain, all of it. This is what it means to live a life. But what do we need? And I make it really specific. What do I need to stick with my intentions, even when the world is burning up around us? It takes a certain amount of confidence. It takes a certain amount of faith that just taking the next step is what we need to do. So here's a beautiful poem from David White called Faith. I want to write about faith. The way the moon rises over cold snow, night after night, faithful even as it fades from fullness, slowly becoming the last curving and impossible sliver of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I refuse it even the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. Isn't that gorgeous? What I love about this last stanza, let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. We have to start somewhere. And so we start with an intention that might not be grand, doesn't have to be. It's an intention that says, maybe one day, someday in the future, I may consider that thought. That's a beginning. That's a beginning. Maybe one day I'll sit and think about letting go of a grudge. Maybe. That's planting the seed. And that's what I love about this practice of faith. It just asks us for the next breath, the next step. We don't have to do it all at once. We can't do it all at once, actually, but we can do the next thing. And sometimes one of the best reflection questions to ask ourselves is, what is the next thing to do? And then maybe that's a place where we get stuck. Or we just think, what's the next thought? What is just the next breath? And that's where we start. So I want to talk about faith, confidence, trust, sadha, from our Buddhist perspective. And then as we go, we'll probably talk with each other a little bit, or I'll offer all of this and then we'll have a good group discussion on it. There are four aspects of faith to look at. And as you hear this, you'll hear that it is somewhat linear. But I want you to be assured that just like all aspects of our practice, it's very circuitous. One thing does lead to the next, but it's not linear. And you'll see how this works. So the first aspect of faith is called bright faith. Bright faith is maybe when we first came to practice in our lives and all the light bulbs started twinkling, everything went on, and we had that feeling of, oh my God, I'm home. This is where I belong. This is the best. Do you know that feeling? You know, when you learn something new or you come into a practice and you think, I finally found it. I'm never leaving. This is the best thing ever. There's a quality of falling in love that happens. And when we fall in love, everything is twinkly, right? It's beautiful. It's warm. It's cozy. It's so good. Maybe there's a little bit of infatuation with whatever the thing is, but it's that sense of having arrived where you belong. That's the sense I got. You know, when I first came into practice many, many years ago, I relaxed and I, you know, I went whole, just went for it. Lots of meditation, lots of reading, really dove in head first. And there's a willingness that's in that. There's a curiosity, there's a courage that happens in this bright faith that is so important because it's what keeps us simmering. I mean, maybe it's on a boil, maybe it's too much. You know, we can't keep up a certain pace that happens with the bright faith, but it does light the fire. And we need that fire lit in order to start cultivating this trust and confidence in practice, not just in practice, because it gives us trust and confidence in our lives. That's where this is leading to. And so we find something good that starts to happen out of it. We feel something maybe new in ourselves. And maybe it's not fireworks. Maybe for some of us, it's smaller than that. As Rafe Martin, a Zen teacher, says, maybe we step out again after that sitting a little lighter, a little steadier, a little happier, a little less heavily there, a bit more present here, and so a bit more capable of just a little more spontaneous kindness and generosity. If that's all we ever got was just a bit more present, a bit more kind, a bit more steady, maybe that would be enough. And that the bright faith of this is enough. Just to know how good this practice is and how it supports us. But then, you know, infatuations end and the passion wanes maybe a little bit. Something shifts in our lives and we realize, oh yeah, that was great for a while, but it's not happening now. Or maybe we miss it and there's something that's happened that's taken us away from the energy of our bright faith practice. And so that's important. That's important to notice, you know, the energy is waning a little bit, or doubts arise, which is really a common thing. My hunch is all of us have had doubts about our lives, but about our practices. Why am I doing this? What's really coming out of this? That's a really common feeling. Of, all right, so I'm sitting and it feels good and sometimes it doesn't feel good, but what am I really doing? So-and-so is so much more further along the path than me. You know, those kinds of thoughts. Everybody else is a better meditator. I don't know what I'm doing. And so then we need support. And then we move into this second aspect of sadha, which is called borrowed faith. This is when we show up for class and we get reminded, oh yeah, this is why I do this. Look at all these other 60 people who have shown up for class today. I'm actually part of them. Or look at all those other people who have shown up for class today, but they know something more than me. I'm just kind of watching from the outside. all kinds of doubts arise in us in practice. And you know, as I think about how doubts have worked for me in my life, it feels like there are two distinct categories of doubt. One is the kind of doubt that is paralyzing, that I can't figure out what to do, I can't figure out the next move, so I don't do anything. And that's a painful place to be because it keeps us so stuck and constricted and maybe many ruminating thoughts over many days or months or years. If you've ever known somebody who has stayed in a job or a relationship way too long and it's caused a lot of harm in their lives, or we can even look at habits that we have that we know don't serve us, but we stay connected to them because we're afraid of letting go. That's the doubt of what might be on the other side. Jan Martel, who wrote The Life of Pi, he says, to choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. Isn't that good? To choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. So to have that kind of mindful, loving awareness of watching how doubt and questioning function in us, that's normal. I mean, it's just, this is how we are, but to be able to see it. The other way that I've experienced doubt is the kind of doubt that leads to some investigation, learning more, that leads to the ability to make good choices. And one of my favorite definitions of mindfulness is choice. When we have the presence of mind, whatever is happening inside of us and outside of us, so we can say, okay, it's like this right now. What do I want to do? How can I respond? That helps answer the questions of doubt. So there are times where I might be working on a project or something in my life that I know I need to ask more questions before I can make a decision, but it's in service of making that decision. And it's with some excitement. It's not out of fear. It's out of, I want to learn more. Or even the ability to say to somebody else, what am I not seeing here? That's one of my favorite developmental questions. Whatever it is that I'm working on, to be able to pause, this is the mindfulness, say, what am I not seeing? And that is how we get into borrowed faith. So borrowed faith is that ability to see, to let other people in, to support us, right? To come back to practice and say, all right, I see how this is working for you. I'm going to hang out with you because I think that's going to give me the company I need. We need to be accompanied on this path and in our lives for this support. Karen Mazin Miller, who's one of my favorite teachers, she's a Zen priest in Los Angeles. She says, meditation is sitting down and seeing just how much we tumble in the cross currents of our likes and dislikes, desires and judgments, worries and doubts, and staying there. Right? Can we stay there and know it's not, we are not going to die? Right? I mean, we can stay there. We're not going to spontaneously combust inside the painful times of our meditation. She says it takes faith to keep going when you're spinning in a swirl of your doubt. Faith in yourself. It takes strength and courage. And this is what I'm talking about around needing strength, steadiness, and courage to be able to let go of what we don't need, and at the same time, keep going. So that's the borrowed faith that we get from each other, knowing that millions of people are in this practice around the globe at any minute, cultivating the same kind of practice, but also having the same kinds of questions. But there's a collective trust and confidence that we can keep going. And the Buddha told us that and showed us that. And we can actually rely on others' practices through both joy and sorrow. Haikun, who was a great Zen master, said, "At the bottom of great doubt lies great awakening." And I think that's really true. He said also, no doubt, no awakening, little doubt, little awakening, great doubt, great awakening. And don't you know this to be true? Or I hope you know that those moments when you've figured something out, right, and the fog lifts, the joy and relief of, okay, now I know my direction. And that's because of this stick-to-itness, that ability to say, yes, this is hard, it's painful, I'm going to keep going. Because that's the confidence, that's the trust that we can. Here's a piece from Mark Nepo from his book called Things That Join the Sea and Sky. Ketut was a great teacher because she claimed to know nothing. Many wanted to work with her. Some would make long journeys in hopes of studying with her, but she disavowed any notion that she accepted students. To those who showed up, she'd simply say, "Let's just walk together for a while and listen." 3 young seekers met in Amsterdam on their way to find her. Gail, a potter from Tucson, Ben, a financial advisor from Dallas, and Jane, a young yoga instructor from Portland. Gail said, "I heard she's very quiet." And Ben added, "I heard she doesn't take very many students." And Jane worried to herself that she might be stern. They shrugged and laughed and made their way. A week later, they were sitting with Ketut on a plateau near her small home, which overlooked a meandering river. And she began, "You've come a very long way to meet yourself." Ben was eager. "There's so much I want to know," Ketut replied. "There's a line in the Talmud that reads, 'Why ruin a perfectly good question with the answer?'" Why ruin a perfectly good question with the answer? Gail spoke up, "Well, are there no answers then?" Ketut went on, "Life unravels the urge to look for an answer. Instead, we're asked to think of questions as teachers to walk with. We're asked to meet questions, not answer them, to give questions away like bread." So this is that piece of doubt that leads to so much fruit. Why ruin a perfectly good question with an answer? There's just so much juice and richness that can come out of that. And so then we move into the next aspect of faith, which is called verified faith. This is where we find our footing in our direct experience of our lives. The benefit of practice, we know something good is happening. And I'm reminded of the Buddha's teaching in the Kalama Sutta, where he says, "Don't believe me. Find out for yourself and trust that." And he says, "I know these teachings work, but go find out for yourself." Or in so many words, "Don't believe me, but it's true. Find out for yourself." And what a marvelous thing for any person to say to us, "I trust you. I trust your ability to do what is right for you, and that ultimately it will be aligned with goodness for yourself and for others, that you will be able to uproot greed, ill will, and delusion just by watching how they work in your life. You will come to the conclusion, this doesn't support me, I will let it go." It's a really beautiful thing that a teacher 2,600 years ago gave us that, and it's still true. That's also what is still true. We can live by our direct experience when we are committed to seeing clearly how it works. And that takes us to the beautiful story from the Buddha, the story of Mara, which I know many of you know, and it's worth bringing back in this context of verified faith. The the mythology goes that when, after many years of the Buddha trying many aesthetic practices to wake up and understand the mind, that he finally sat down under the Bo tree and decided, I'm not getting up until I've figured out suffering and the end of suffering, how this mind really works. And Mara was known as the trickster, the coyote, the one who kept trying to trip up the Buddha and say things like, why do you think you deserve to do this? What makes you think you're worthy here? Why do you, don't you think there are other people who can do this? And he kept giving to Mara, as he sat under the tree, all these distractions, what are called the armies of Mara, the temptations to get the Buddha to get up and say, all right, forget it, you're right, you're right. And the story goes that every single time one of these other distractions came to the Buddha said, Mara, I see you. Mara, I see you, and I'm not afraid. And it said that the arrows of Mara's armies would just turn into flowers and float to the ground when the Buddha said, Mara, I see you. And not only that, within that story, there was a quality in the Buddha that said, I have a right to be here. No, Mara, I have a right to wake up and to be present in my life. I belong. Such an important thing to keep reminding ourselves that we belong, that this practice is wholesome and powerful and important. And we get to do it. We get to do this. We can wake up. And when I say wake up, what I'm talking about is these deeper and deeper levels of understanding that allow us to live our lives from a wholesome place that doesn't harm ourselves or anyone else, because we are seeing more clearly, more often. It doesn't mean that we don't go through cycles of confusion, but we go through cycles of confusion and clarity. And when we're in those moments of getting tripped up, can we say, Mara, I see you. Oh, this is Mara. This is Mara. So what are the things that are our own habits that trip us up? Just to know those. So, you know, just as a small example, I don't watch scary movies because I can't sleep if I watch scary movies. So do I have habits that are the Mara habits that aren't good for me? Can I let those go? And so I don't do that anymore because I can't do that. So we start seeing what are our habits that lead to our well-being and what are the habits that don't. And we let those go. That's the practice of renunciation, supported by the practice of sada, of faith, of trust and confidence, that we can know ourselves intimately and make good choices. And we can trust ourselves. Last story. This comes from Terry Tempest Williams in her book, When Women Were Birds. Really magnificent book. In the arid foothills of the Wasatch Mountains, the Milky Way arched over us. It was the nightly path our eyes crossed before we went to sleep. This was my personal universe with its own inherent truths. Truth, for me, was based on what I could see and hear, touch and taste, more trustworthy than any religious doctrine. Indoor religion bores me. Outdoor religion did not. Rufous-sided towies scratched in the understory of last year's leaves. Lazuli buntings were turquoise exclamation marks singing in a canopy of green. And blue-gray gnatcatchers became commas in an ongoing narrative of wild nature. My inspiration was winged. Magpies, evening grosbeaks, and scrub jays were family. Turkey vultures soared overhead, casting unexpected shadows during summer heat. Rattlesnakes were our complication to a life outside. We heard them first, saw them second, coiled, and before we counted to three, we ran. Clouds became our focal point for change. One day, however, I was sitting in our treehouse. I spotted a white bird perched directly above me. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. I went into the house to call my grandmother, still watching the ghost bird through the glass sliding doors that faced the trees. I explained the size and shape of this mysterious bird to be that of a robin, only without a brown back, black head, and red breast. She listened carefully. We both had our bird books in hand. "Perhaps it's an albino," she said. "A bird without pigmentation, even its eyes without color." That very word, albino, was a revelation to me. She might as well have said, "of the spirit world." It was indeed a robin, the most common of birds, free of its prescribed dressings, white with red eyes. I was inspired and called her the Holy Ghost. When I reported this finding to our local Audubon chapter as an 8-year-old bird watcher, the president said that because of my age, he could not legitimately count it as a credible sighting. My grandmother simply shook her head and said, "You know what you saw. The bird doesn't need to be counted, and neither do you." Verified faith, right? We do this from what we know, our direct experience. And how dare that president of the Audubon Society to reject an 8-year-old sighting? You know, and how do we reject one another because we think that their views are not true or valid? It's an important question. Do we reject one another because of how we are stuck in our own conditioned beliefs, the problem of fixed views? So you can start seeing how this practice of renunciation and the practice of faith are two sides of the same coin. They're completely integrated. Can you trust yourself? Feel that growing confidence. That's the verified faith. And lastly, abiding faith. This place that we rest in, out of which our lives really do form, how we really live out of that. It's grown from wisdom and equanimity. All of our practices, the Brahmaviharas of metta and compassion, joy, equanimity, gratitude, empathy, forgiveness, all of it. And they become a continual resource of practice. And so these four aspects of bright faith, borrowed faith, verified faith, and abiding faith, they are not solid. They are there. We work with them as they support our lives, but I think we all go through cycles where we're experiencing all of them in different ways. There are some things that our bright faith is really there about, some things that our bright faith is bringing us into something new where we're growing. It might be our leading edge of growth, but we also have a quality of verified and abiding faith that keeps us rooted. And then we go, go check with somebody else on this, you know, and then we borrow it a little bit from somebody else. We might have a difficult day, right? And we get a little tripped up. So none of this is, well, it's not permanent, right? Because nothing is permanent. This and while it may feel quite linear, it depends on which lens you're looking through, which day, what experience. And we can rely, I believe, on our commitments to non-harming, our commitments towards kindness, to really support the strength and the steadiness and courage that we need to keep going forward, even when the skies are this bizarre color that we're living through what we are living through. We can do it. Do you know the story of the monk on the vine? You might know it. I know some of you know it, but I think it's a beautiful example. And so the way this story goes is one day there was a monk walking through the forest along the edge of a big drop-off, a cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was this raging river. And he's walking along the top of this bluff, and the forest is here and enjoying himself. But he got this sense of being followed, you know, that feeling of, oh, there's something behind me. And he kept looking around and didn't see anything and was walking, but he started to get scared. And the adrenaline started to rumble and move in his body. And then he looked out of the corner of his eye and saw there was a tiger who was stalking him, walking behind. And so then he started to walk faster and faster, and the tiger is walking faster and faster. And finally, this monk knew the tiger was going to eat him. So the only way out of this was to climb down this cliff down to the river. So he climbs over this roof, holding onto these vines, big rope vines, to lower himself down. And as he's lowering himself down, the tiger's up above, snarl, 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 and it's pretty scary. And as he's holding onto these vines, out of a little crack in this cliff comes a mouse and starts gnawing on the vine. Now what's he gonna do? And he looks over to the left arm, and he sees the raging river, and he sees the tiger up above and the mouse gnawing on the vine. And then right there in another crack of the wall is a strawberry. And he eats the strawberry. That's it. Eats the strawberry. Can we do that? In the midst of threat, can we find that peace that we're still okay? There is something that can still support us and hold us. And this is the practice of faith, of sadha. It's said the Buddha's penultimate teaching was to look around everybody who was with him at his death and say, strive on with diligence. Strive on with diligence. Also translated by, I think, Andrew Olensky as, move into the future with confidence. Move into the future with confidence. And that might feel so hard right now, but it is really the next step. It is just take the next step. What are you doing in the next hour? Move into the future with confidence. And it might be, I'm just going to sit down and read a book because it's going to settle my nervous system. And I can't figure anything else out. But right now, I'm going to do this. Or maybe I'm going to learn to make something new today in the kitchen. That I can do. And I think that's what the Buddha was saying, is trust yourself. Let go of what doesn't serve you. Don't harm yourself. Be kind. Don't harm anybody else. You can do this. It will be painful and it will be joyful, and you can do it. So let's talk with each other. Any kinds of questions, reflections, comments, let's just open it up. You can use the hand raise signal. You can chat something in. You can raise your hand and Carlita will help us.
Absolutely. While everyone's gathering their thoughts and questions and reflections, I just want to say on behalf of everyone, thank you so much, Heidi.
Oh,
you
so
brought such a deep and rich talk to us today, last week. So deep gratitude. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wonderful offering. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Beautiful. Okay, great. Kathleen.
Hi. And thank you, Heidi. I agree. That was really outstanding. And it's just, it really kind of reverberates with a number of other things that are happening and I've heard of. And I'm definitely going to buy the Women Were Birds book. I think I've had that recommended to me in various forms 3 times in the last 2 weeks. So I think it's
there you go. It's time. It's time.
It is time. So my question is about starting down the path. So loved the different stages. It seems, if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly, that that bright faith, that lighting of the fire, is a important first step or an important gateway into building faith. First off, did I interpret that correctly?
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing that got you here today.
So my question is, if someone is, or if you're, even if you're trying to help someone as a teacher or trying to do it for yourself, how does one open up to the possibility that that bright faith situation could happen? I'm saying that, you know, you can't force it, but it seems like you could create conditions maybe that could increase the chances that it would happen. So anyway, that's my question.
Yeah, that's a great point. You're right. We can't manufacture a feeling, right? Feelings arise. We can't manufacture that spark. But I think that if we think back on our lives, there may be sparks that have happened quite spontaneously. And so it doesn't have to be related to spiritual practice, I don't think. Because really what we're doing is trying to apply this spiritual practice as a support into our daily life, as everything is practice. So when I think back on what are the sparks that happened in my life that inspired other actions, like as an example, the very first time I went on a hike in the Rocky Mountains, and my dad took me on that hike, what that opened up for me was a new life. And so I had this bright faith of what it means to, what I accessed in myself just through the activity of hiking. Does this make sense? Are you with me on this? Am I getting to you? So it's about the spark. And it's about the spark that you know, oh, this is good. But you can't manufacture it. I think these things happen quite naturally and outside of our control. But it's being awake for it. It's being present for your life to notice, oh, that stimulated something in me that I have to follow. This is important. This is a pathway for me. So that's the trick, is to be present enough and to have the confidence that when the sparks, the inspirations come in our lives, to pay attention to it, to know that that's an important piece for us because it opens up a gateway to the rest. Yeah, you're welcome.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Kathleen, for that question. Heidi, I did have a question that came in via text, and that is, if you could please clarify the stages verified faith and abiding faith.
The difference between verified and abiding. You know, I think it's very subtle. The difference between verified faith and and abiding. I think the verified faith is that place of coming back to, oh yeah, I do know that. I do know that. Like, you know, when I see that albino bird, I know I see that albino bird. That's what it is. And I don't have to second guess myself. But there might be the inclination to second guess myself. I think my own experience with abiding faith is it's just there. And second guessing doesn't happen at all. It's just there. So as an example, a practice example, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that when I don't have negative thoughts in my mind about myself or anybody else, I am so much more content. That piece of contention has dissolved. And I know for sure that when I live out of that place of a warm heart, I am much healthier in every respect in my life. That is abiding faith. That is always there for me. It lives in me. However, do I always do it? Maybe not, because I'm human. So I have to re-verify that all the time. I have to go back to the practice of, oh yes, this metta is so important. Look at all those disparaging thoughts I had in my mind. I'm not happy when I have disparaging thoughts. That's true. And what is abiding in me is that place that says, you already know this. You already know this. I have to verify it again. I hope that's a helpful answer. I think that the differences are subtle.
Okay, great. Perfect. Thank you so much for that, Heidi. Next, we have Nancy. Nancy, you are unmuted.
Yep, I am. Heidi, what you were saying about the sparks really resonated with me because that has been my experience. And the things that have been sparks for me in particular are people and books.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you have to be open to receiving those messages of the examples of people or the teachings of people that are going to move you in a completely new direction. And it takes a certain amount of curiosity and courage
to
take those steps because they are leading you away from where you have been. And it takes that openness and the courage to try to move in those new directions. And where my faith comes in is that if I remain open and if I am willing to hear those messages, they're going to come to me. Those opportunities are going to be presented by the universe. I don't know what force you would call it, but I truly have the feeling of being guided in my life.
There is some letting go and trusting that is true in this. I think that that's right. And I love that you pointed out that it takes courage, willingness, curiosity, and a fundamental trust in ourselves. I can do this. And this is how this whole thing is all, you know, one integrated whole about the faith, the trust, the confidence in ourselves, or that the literal translation to place the heart upon. You know, can we follow the heart? I love that translation because we know when the heart is moved, there's something right in that. You know, when our heart isn't moved, it's not what sparks us. So following that movement, that inspiration, and trusting the process is critical. I'm so glad you brought that in, Nancy. Yeah, it's really true.
All right, thank you so much. We have Janine. Hi, Janine.
Hi there. I love the talk. I love the analogy of the crack in the cement. Oh my gosh, that really helped me understand what's going on with some of my friends. So I've had two friends, mutual friends. The three of us know each other really well. And one definitely had the crack open of her own accord. And she almost has a garden growing in that crack now. And our other friend is just struggling to let that crack open up. And it just really helped me when you said that. And for me, it's that modeling. It's like a subtle thing that happens when somebody's so guarded. If your good friend is showing how they can be happy and not fearful in these trying times, that is where I think the crack can open for them, because they ask themselves, why, how can they be so happy and calm during this situation?
You know, we all
have, that's what I wanted to share.
Yeah, no, that's a really, really important piece, Janine, because we all have different wiring and we come in with different wiring. You know, some of us are much more resilient than others. And when I say the word resilience, I mean the ability to bounce back within or even after difficulty. And it's influenced by our conditioning, by our genetics, everything that has happened to us, that two people can experience the same thing and have extremely different experiences with it. And even though one friend may be thriving and the other friend just isn't, we need different things. And maybe the one who is not thriving can't yet. And the example of the one who is, wonderful. But you know, that back to that metaphor of the crack in the concrete, isn't it extraordinary that a dandelion can make its way through the concrete and bloom? That's amazing to me. Like that survival of a seed underneath concrete, literally. And somehow some air and light gets in there and it finds its way and it emerges. And so I think what my hope would be for the friend who is struggling is to know that in time, her seed will make the way through, and that we can't all do this at the same rate. And it can be deflating to see somebody who is doing well, or even the question, how dare you do well in the middle of these crises? But we actually need to be as healthy as we can in order to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Because it's so hard. And also when we're going through difficult times, to give ourselves the self-compassion of, this is really challenging for me. I'm not doing well today. And allowing that to be who we are and not to try to be who we can't be. But to give ourselves the courage to know that in time, it will change.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
While we are waiting for additional hands to come up or texts to come in, Heidi, I have a question for you to kind of tag team off of Janine's. You gave a beautiful quote by the Buddha this morning, that was about taking that next best step. I was just hoping you could state that again.
Sure. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? It's a beautiful compass question. I use it all the time. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness?
Wonderful. Thank you.
And you know, it doesn't mean that we only do what is going to be for my long-term welfare and happiness. Mm. You know, it might mean that, and this is a really, really basic example. Last night, my husband and I were celebrating our 35th wedding anniversary. And 35 years. And I went and bought this pastry. It was this very decadent, dense, flourless chocolate dense, you know, cake. It was not even cake, you know, it's just like fudge. I hadn't eaten anything like that in a long time. That was definitely not for my long-term welfare. It took me a long time to fall asleep last night from all of that intense chocolate. But so what, right? Like, we don't have to hold ourselves up on this pedestal of not having really dense, delicious chocolate cake. So let's hold it lightly. Let's keep this in perspective about what the Buddha was talking about. Really important. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's always such an honor and a privilege. May all beings be safe and protected, have enough to eat, have adequate shelter, be part of a welcoming community, and may all this suffering be eased.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.